I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello and welcome once more to the podcast. It's been a while since we've done one of these, Pete.
Jeez, the podcasts that never end.
We've been on our holidays.
Yeah, you had a great time, didn't
had
you?
Had a fantastic time. I would heartily recommend York and Durham to anybody. Nice walks, largely downhill.
Yes, that you were uncomplaining throughout.
I was uncomplaining the whole time.
You were. Now, what are we doing today then?
Well, today, Pete, we're going to continue to tell the story of the Battle of the Somme. And today, it's the battle for Thiepval Ridge, which I think is September 1916.
Yeah, it starts on 26th of September. And it's one of the most awful battles in British military history. I mean, there are a lot, and people always say these things. But it is a bad one, and there'll be no funny accents and no humour much in this one. There shouldn't be. If there is, I apologise in advance for any slippage.
So how did we find ourselves here?
That was Fred speaking.
On the 26th of September. What led us here, Pete?
Well, it's just that they've been fighting all summer, edging their way forward in the south. They've ground their way forward on the Pozieres Ridge. Now it's the turn of the Reserve Army, later on the Fifth Army, commanded by Sir Hubert Gough. And Haig, but after the relative success of the Battle of Flers Courcelette, which we did, I think, in our last podcast, Haig was convinced the moment had come that the German reserves, and if you like, their resolve to continue this and Verdun at the same time, they're finally failing, and he orders Gough and Reserve Army to strike hard at you'll recognise some of the original objectives of the 1st of July. So we're talking about Schwab and Redoubt. Now, what was that to the Germans?
A Schwerpunkt.
That's it. I thought I'd let you say that. Thanks, mate. Think of Jack Sheldon, because he's the one who first brought that concept firmly to our mind. And Thiepval Ridge. So this is the original objectives for the 1st of July. And they're now going to try and get them. And what does Haig plan after he's got Thiepval Ridge?
Well, once it's captured, he plans an advance towards Serre and pushing out from Beaumont Hamel. Now, there is an argument that Gough was too optimistic and that he too was taken with the idea that the time had come to strike.
So you're going to be Sir Hubert Gough, General Sir Hubert Gough, commanding a reserve army. What have you got to say about it?
The reserve army had not so far been in a position to attack on so broad a front or to deploy so many divisions. The front of attack was well supported by artillery, and from many positions southwest and west of Thiepval, we swept the defenders in enfilade and exposed them to a heavy crossfire.
Now, this attack was going to be carried out on a front of some 6,000 yards. So notice again, we're concentrating our attacks, but it is still a wide front, but it's not as wide as we couldn't manage to do on the first day of the Somme. 6,000 yards, and it was going to be done by 2nd Corps. Who's in 2nd Corps? Quick chest.
Second Corps is the 18th and 11th Divisions, who are alongside the Canadian
Corps.
Who are they? That's the 1st and 2nd Canadian Divisions, Pete. The clue's in the word Canadian.
Oh, yeah, I suppose it would be. Now, the artillery sport, would that be important, do you think?
Oh, it's going to be crucial. And so they mass some 230 heavy guns and 570 field guns, and they're soon blazing away, but also being supplemented by the artillery further north, which could strike deep into the rear of the German positions.
That's because of the configuration of the front.
Yeah. Now, this is your point about, you know, the guns getting behind the lines, as it were. And that was done from the north. Now,
there's something new, though. Well, not new, but there's another... This increasingly, as the war goes on, they add to the mix of weapons being used in an attack. Now, this is where... This is one of the most noticeable uses of the Vickers machine gun, which by this time have been banded together to form a real punching power. So what are how do they supplement the artillery barrage?
Well, they put a constant oozing stream of bullets, which rather bizarrely are directed into the air. Now, this is carefully...
Like Cock Robin.
Yeah, this is carefully calculated to fall back to earth and in doing so, spattering across the German positions. Now, I'd never, ever thought about that.
The idea is to fire, and it's things like points where communication trenches come out in the open ground, they could just about place it. It's that sort of thing you aim, and you just hose it with bullets falling out of the sky.
Yeah, because what goes up must come down.
Well, usually, yeah.
Well, it certainly did in Durham.
Yeah. Now, so on the right of the front, the attack's going to go off at 12:35. That's midday and a bit.
Well
just,
done.
Just checking. And the Canadians on the right, they'll push towards Courcelette, striking towards Zollern Trench and Zollern Redoubt. Next to them, the 11th Division, they're going to capture the ruins of Mouquet Farm. Haven't we heard that?
We've heard that before.
Haven't people
we?
Been capturing Mouquet Farm for, yeah, the Australians are battering their way towards there. The Mouquet Farm is a tremendous sticking point.
Now, we're going to concentrate on what the 18th Division are doing, and they're attacking towards the Thiepval Ridge and Chateau, with behind them the, I think you describe it as grim fastness of Schwaben Redoubt.
The Schwerpunkt.
The Schwerpunkt.
Oh, swear.
Now, the 54th Brigade was charged with taking Thiepval itself. The 12th Middlesex and 11th Royal Fusiliers would lead the way, with the 6th Northamptons coming up in reserve as required. Now, when the orders are given to an old friend of ours, Lieutenant Colonel Frank Maxwell, VC, of the 12th Middlesex...
Now, he's the chap who was in Trones Wood.
Yes. And I think we've mentioned him in a very recent podcast.
We did.
Now, he knew that all his accumulated military skills... plus a large slice of sheer good luck would be required if he and his men were to have any chance of surviving their daunting task.
Daunting.
And you are going to be, rather fittingly in my opinion, Lieutenant Colonel Frank Maxwell of the 12th Middlesex Regiment.
Is he sort of lovable?
He's exactly like you. Lovable.
July 1st was a playground compared to it, and the resistance small. I confess I hated the job from the first. So many attempts had been made and so many failures that one knew it could only be a tough thing to take on, and I hadn't personally any particular hopes of accomplishing it. More especially as a distance to be covered, nearly 1 mile, was enormous for these attacks under any circumstances and under the special one of a country absolutely torn with shell fire for 3 months. It was, I considered, an impossibility. Now, what does a British officer do when he's ordered to accompany something that's impossible? Does he whine or complain, or does he just get on with it?
He gets on with it. And
I think that's an important point.
Arguably, sometimes they shouldn't.
But in this particular case, I think they should, and he thought so too. So what happened? The artillery crash out for the attack that's going to go in at 12:35. Concentrated barrage, and shells are slathered all over the German trenches. And you're going to be Private Reginald Emmett of the 11th Royal Fusiliers, one of the two battalions leading the assault.
Shells crashed over and around our trenches. Machine guns chattered as their fire swept to and fro across our path as we stumbled forward through no man's land, doubled up in the faint hope of dodging bullets. We'd been told not to bunch up together, as that would be an easy target, so from the first, each man was on his own. Here and there were men tangled up in barbed wire, many dead. The ground was uphill, and we did not have far to go to reach the German front line, smashed by our artillery, where we found a few Germans.
Blimey. So what happens when what happens in these circumstances?
Well, the surviving fusiliers, they take their awful vengeance and they hunt down their quarry in a manner that sort of combines a bloodlust with a murderous efficiency. Mm. And you're going to be Second Lieutenant George Cornerby, also of the 11th Royal Fusiliers.
We met Bosch running about, scared out of their wits, like a crowd of rabbits diving for their holes. Men were rushing about unarmed, men were holding up their hands and yelling for mercy. Men were scuttling about everywhere, trying to get away from that born fighter, the Cockney. But they had very little chance. I had the pleasure of shooting four of them before I was wounded in the wrist. After this, everything seemed blurred.
Wow. Now, with the German first line successfully overrun, the men of the 11th Royal Fusiliers push further forward and they move as fast as they can in the appalling conditions.
Now, you're going to be Private Emmett again, aren't you? And you're heading for what room... There's not much left of it, is there, really? The ruins or the remnants or the dust of the Thiepval Chateau.
We shot anything that moved and dragged ourselves out and onto the next trench. We'd been told to make for the ruins of a castle, and dazed and exhausted as I was, I dragged myself to a little hill where there was a pile of stones, all that was left of the castle, I supposed. Here, the German machine gun fire became fiercer than ever, just sweeping above the ground. I threw myself into a shell hole, and seizing my chance as the bullets whistled over my head, I slid from shell hole to shell hole into a third German trench where some of our boys were held up.
Now, normally I would correct your pronunciation of the word castle to castle, but after our experiences in the north of England, I'm sure you realise. Well, but this chap is an 11th Royal Fusiliers, so I think you got it perfectly right, and I congratulate you on your ability to read even something as wrong as that right.
Now, at this point, they're told by an officer that they'd actually reached their objective. Emmett's company had been assigned to the role of mopping up the German dugouts, and the wounded Second Lieutenant George Cornerby watched them in action. And you're once more going to be Second Lieutenant George Cornerby.
I found myself in a shell hole with one of my men. Remember, he'd been wounded in the wrist.
In the wrist, yeah.
With one of my men who was also wounded. We patched each other up and then went on. I have visions of excited men tearing after the Boche. Visions of men sitting over dugout entrances, waiting to shoot the first Boche that appeared. Sounds almost like good fun. It's not, is it? And you're going to be Private Reginald Emmett of the 11th Royal Fusiliers, same regiment, who's one of these men. It may be, I mean, the great thing is Cornerby could have been looking at you as Emmett.
I started by shouting down, telling any Germans left to come up. If there was no response, I fired a few shots and then threw a bomb down. We got quite a few. Some came up holding their hands up and shouting, "Kamerad!" Others held up photographs of their wives and children. We had to be very quick on them, for some still had a bit of fight left in them and pulled out revolvers, but we soon knocked them off. The survivors were sent back down the line in charge of a corporal, but many got shot on the way, for many of our boys were mad with what they had gone through and the strain of it all, and just shot anything in a German uniform.
We'll come back to this, because I know Maxwell mentions it later on. Now, Private Fuller, he's the 8th Suffolk. Now, he's in the neighbouring 53rd Brigade, and he saw just something awful as they were hunting down any resisting Germans and anybody who wasn't resisting. And you're going to be Private Sidney Fuller.
One was lying buried almost to the neck by a shell which had dropped near, but still alive. I shall never forget the expression on this man's face. Ghastly white, his eyes staring with terror, unable to move, while our chaps threw bombs past him down the dugout stairs, and the enemy inside threw their bombs out.
What do you think it was like for that bloke?
Horrific.
It's beyond... beyond comprehension. This is why we use oral history and personal experience accounts. Now, the 12th Middlesex, they're fighting away through the ruins of the Thiepval Chateau. Colonel Frank Maxwell makes that his battle headquarters. What do you think his situation is?
Well, his responsibilities are growing all the time, and they're fast expanding as both Colonel Carr of the 11th Royal Fusiliers and Colonel Ripley of the 6th Northamptons, they were both knocked out in the fighting. So the simply irrepressible Colonel Maxwell just takes over effective command of all three battalions.
Are you saying I'm irrepressible?
I'm saying, well, I can't possibly say that, mostly because I can't pronounce it. So you are once more going to be Lieutenant Colonel Frank Maxwell of the 12th Middlesex Regiment.
It was an extraordinarily difficult battle to fight, owing to every landmark, such as a map shows, being obliterated. Absolutely and totally. The ground was, of course, a limit itself, and progress over it like nothing imaginable. The enemy, quite determined to keep us out, as they had so many times before. And I must say that they fought most stubbornly and bravely. Probably not more than 300 to 500 put their hands up. They took it out of us badly, but we did ditto. And I have no shame in saying so. As every German should, in my opinion, be exterminated, I don't know that we took one, he means prisoner. I have not seen a man or officer yet who did anyway. So he's saying that his battalion, 12th Middlesex, didn't take prisoners. What do you think this is?
Well,
how do you feel about this, Gary? Where are we?
Well, this is the old cruelty of the medieval wars, isn't it? Where you fight to the end and you literally fought to your end. There was no mercy given or to be had at the last.
So if you wanted to surrender, you had to surrender before it was serious.
Yeah, you can't surrender having, you know,
shot everybody down in front
of you and then say, oh, I surrender now. And because it wouldn't be accepted. Now, small isolated parties of soldiers from both the 11th Royal Fusiliers and the 12th Middlesex Regiment battalions, they fought their way down these trenches that filled the village area.
That's the village of Tietval itself.
Yeah, now bombs are the main weapon, followed by the quick and deadly rush with the bayonet.
Well, we talked about this, where you throw a bomb. In fact, you once participated in a famous demonstration of this, where you throw the bomb round the corner of the trench, it goes off, you wait for the fragments to settle, which is a matter of a second, and then rush round and bayonet any survivors, and then it repeats itself. This is dreadful, murderous fighting, isn't it?
It is. Now, it's incredibly difficult to determine what's going on, and it's even more difficult trying to keep General Ivor Max at 18th Division headquarters abreast of the situation.
He's the commander of the 18th Division, isn't he?
He is. And, you know, you're now once more going to be Lieutenant Colonel Frank Maxwell to explain some of the difficulties.
Perhaps the most trying business is to keep your generals informed of how things are going. It is extraordinarily difficult. For on a field like that at Thiepval, telephone lines don't remain uncut by shells for more than 5 minutes. And yet they must know things, of course, and must get their information by lamp or runner. By lamp, it is laborious for no answer to say message, or rather word received, is possible in case the enemy should see the replying lamp and put the artillery on its position. I didn't read that well, but you'll get the
Makes
idea.
Sense.
If the message is sent by, I understand the next bit, if the message is sent by runner, it means long distances on foot. By day, the runner is usually killed or wounded. By night, he gets lost. No, I do understand that. But what I take from that whole thing is he's pointing out the practical difficulties, which are often, why don't the generals do this, that and the other? It's because they don't know what's happened. Because the officers at the front cannot get word back. There's just no means. And it's just a fact of life, isn't it? Now, what's the situation by the time? So they start at 12:30, midday-ish. What happens by the time night fell?
Well, by the time night falls, they hold the entire village except for the northwest corner, where a strong German machine gun post still holds out.
So what's the priority now? What do they have to do?
You've got to consolidate. It's all important. Because what do the Germans do?
They counterattack, Gary. And you're going to be Private Reginald Emmett talking about how they did it.
We started to get the trench ready to resist, building up the parapet facing the other way round, because obviously it's going to be facing the wrong way. This meant heaving the German dead bodies over the top, a gruesome job, which covered us with blood. This done, we waited through the night. Some explored the dugouts, which were well supplied with drink and cigars, and came up wearing German helmets. Those who had them divided up their rations and tried to get a little sleep through sheer exhaustion. The counter-attack never came.
That's interesting. I mean, it's a sign of the strain on the Germans. Now, where am I?
Well, Colonel Maxwell.
That's me.
I'm assuming that's who you mean.
I mean, I've taken on the role very seriously now, Gary.
He spent the night at the Thiepval Chateau.
And here I am. I find Maxwell an absolutely fascinating character because there's definitely two or three sides to him, some of which are admirable and two or three which are quite sharp. There's a Patton-esque, if you know what I mean by Patton-esque.
No.
You know General Patton from the Second World War?
Oh, Patton-esque. Mm-hmm. I thought you meant Patton as in a Patton.
It's the southern-northern divide of pronunciation there, I suspect. Anyway, this is what Colonel Maxwell says. He's in the dungeons, I like to call it, but basement of the Thiepval Chateau. I had a safe place in a pile of ruins which managed to ward off shells and all the other unpleasant things of a modern battle. It was a very busy night for me, though, and not unmixed with anxiety. In fact, very much the contrary.
These words are actually part of a letter that that he wrote home. And he was being observed by a slightly awed, wounded officer. You made the point earlier about, you know, Cornerby could be looking at Emmett. He was actually looking at Colonel Frank Maxwell. And he was experiencing the full force of his forceful and slightly irascible personality for the first time.
I'm forceful and slightly irascible? I am very irascible.
I wouldn't use the word slightly, no.
Yeah, no, very. Yeah.
Now, once more, you're going to be Second Lieutenant George Cornerby of the 11th Royal Fusiliers.
Who wasn't, of course, in Maxwell's battalion. So this will be the first time he'd probably seen him. For some hours during the night, Colonel Maxwell was writing diligently, page after page. It was supposed popularly to be a letter to his wife, and appears to have been so. Shells were passing over and dropping all the time, and one runner, who had the wind up, gave a groan every time one came. Suddenly, Maxwell got up from his writing, saying, "I can't stand this any longer. Send that man here." He then told everyone to stand in line, said, "I'll give him the first kick, then the rest of you pass him along." And the runner was passed out into the dark. In other words, he formed up a line, they all booted the bloke, passed him out. Is that reasonable or rational behaviour by an officer?
Yeah. I experience that often.
No, it's not. But it is. It shows what sort of a man he was. It's quite interesting. Now, what's the overall situation on the nightfall on the 26th of September? We've looked at but what's happening?
Well, basically, the reserve army are simply exhausted.
The assault battalions are.
Yeah, and the reserve battalions, they're moved forward at this point. But in doing so, they're threatened by the vicious German counter bombardment that's falling all across the newly captured trenches.
So this is quite. So what's happening is that the Germans haven't counterattacked yet, but what they are doing is blasting hell out of what's going on. And of course, they were in their own trenches. They knew exactly the range to them. They had it taped to the inch, I suppose. Now you're going to be Private Thomas Jennings, 1st, 6th. Royal Berkshire Regiment. He's one of the reserve battalions that moved up, I presume. I can't check that, but I presume. So you're going to read this.
Dusk was creeping up fast, and then came the biggest barrage Jerry ever sent over, and well, we knew it. We rushed about in all directions and dived into the old trenches that were knee-deep in oozy, greasy mud, running from bay to bay to escape the jagged metal showering down from the HE, heavy explosives. It fell like white hot cinders around us and sizzled in the wet earth of the trench. High. This went on throughout the hours of darkness until dawn came, when the enemy gunners ceased firing as they didn't want to be spotted by our aircraft. What a sight met our gaze in daylight. The trench must have been a terrible hot spot during the past few weeks, for buried in its walls were dozens of bodies, both British and German, rotting in the wet earth. A khaki-clad leg or arm protruded from the sides, and a couple of Jerrys wrapped in blankets, complete with jackboots, were acting as silent sentinels either side of a dugout. During the night, my mates and I had been close companions to all these corpses. The lull before the storm, as we called the silence that daylight brought, enabled us to leave the mortuary and look further afield. More horrors were brought to our eyes. What a sight! a huge crater about 50 yards away. Its occupants were the dead of our soldiers who made the advance on the 1st of July, nearly 3 months before. They lay, sat, or reclined in all positions, skeletons covered with the greenish skin and flesh of decomposition. One that I noticed in particular was lying on his back, his belly a moving mass of maggots. I was about to retreat to the trench when our captain came across to reprimand us for being away from our positions. Then he ordered us to search the bodies for their personal belongings and pay books. This helped to clear up the missing, believed killed problem. We found out that they were from the West Country, the Dorsets in fact. It wasn't a very pleasant task.
Now, this is a horrific idea or quote, and the state, it's just awful. Anyway, Jennings must have been, he must have been in some sort of state of shock at all this. Now, he's a Lewis gun, he's got a Lewis gun team. They're given a dugout for the night, and just more, there's more fun in there, isn't there?
Once more, I'm going to be Private Thomas Jennings. With the light of a candle, we looked round our new quarters. A German officer, bare from the waist up, was lying on a bunk with a mass of bandages around his middle. He'd died from a severe wound. Another Jerry was lying dead on the floor. Rather reluctant to haul them up the 20-odd steps, we covered them with blankets and promptly forgot about them. It was a case of out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah. Well, that is what soldiers are like as well. And that I've read lots of quotes and things of that nature. Now, next morning, there's more to remind them of the fighting that had been going on there for the last 3 months. And you're again going to be Private Thomas Jennings.
We investigated all the trench from one end to the other. In the next bay were three Jerrys kneeling in a pool of blood. Their tunics were blood red instead of filled grey. Their faces from the forehead to the chin were missing, completely blasted away. But why were they kneeling? Had they been at prayer? Going in the other direction, we came across a strange sight. There were perhaps a dozen or more Jerrys on steps that appeared to be emerging from a dugout. They were as dead as doormats, and I was prompted to give the first one a push and send them all tumbling to the bottom. Well, I didn't succumb to the temptation.
Well, this gives you an idea. This is the battlefield. This is what people imagine the First World War to be like all the time. It is like that on this occasion and in this place. You can over-exaggerate this sort of death and destruction everywhere, but in this particular case, it's definitely true, isn't it? Now, that same night, the 7th Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire Regiment, they infiltrated their way forward to relieve the people who captured Tiapval. And what they're getting ready to do, what would you say they're going to do next?
Well, they're getting ready to spring forward to clear what remains northwest of the Tiapval village before dawn on the morning of the 27th. Now, amongst them was Lieutenant Tom Adlam, who was temporarily in command of a company.
Rapid promotion.
That's some promotion, isn't it? At the colonel's briefing, he was given his deceptively simple instructions. Under the cover of darkness, they were to break into the German trench and then bomb their way along to establish strong outposts on the trenches leading directly into the heart of the threatening Schwaben Redoubt, slightly to the north of the village.
So the idea is that this is going to establish a base from which to attack the Schwaben Redoubt itself. Now, I'm going to be Lieutenant Tom Adlam, and there's going to be a lot of this, so I'll just introduce it. This is taken from an interview carried out by the Imperial War Museum. When Adlam was not that much older than I am now, he's about 70 and 75. It was recorded in the 70s. It's a very rare thing, and you must note this, Gary, it's a very rare thing. It's a VC, a Victoria Cross winner, talking in detail about how he won it and how he felt and what was going on in his head. And so there's a lot of this, but I think it's worthwhile. We've got a lot of quotes from him and I'm just gathering my thoughts ready to go. So Lieutenant Tom Adlam, 7th Beds and Hearts. The guides that were taking us up all got lost except in my company. I thought, yes, it would be us. Luckily, just before we started the attack, my company commander came and took over. It had taken us, so he's replaced as company commander. It had taken us so long to get into position that it was quite daylight. I knew that we weren't supposed to do this in daylight, but he said, well, get along. And we got over. I was lucky because the part my platoon was opposite was only about 100 yards. Then the trench, that's the German trench they were attacking, swung back 45 degrees. So if they were further along, they'd have had a lot further to go. We only got a certain way, then the machine guns started and we all went into the shell holes.
Wow. Now, Lieutenant Tom Adlam, certainly no ordinary young man. He wasn't prepared to just sit around and wait for something to happen. He was going to make things happen and trust to his own luck.
Now, he's a bloke who's going to make the difference. The modern army call it men who make the difference, or women, sorry. But people who make the difference in action.
And you're once more going to be Lieutenant Tom Adlam.
I thought, we've got to get in this trench somehow or other. What are we going to do about it? And instead of doing nothing, he said this. So I went crawling along from shell hole to shell hole till I came to the officer in charge of the next platoon. I said, "What do you think about it, Father?" We always called him Father. That was his nickname. I don't know who he was, but that was his father. He said, "I'm going to wait here till it gets dark, then crawl back. We can't go forward." And this, Adam's having none of this. He says, I said, "Well, I think we can. Where I am, I'm not more than 50 yards from the trench, and I think I can get in." He shook hands with me solemnly and said, "Goodbye, old man." I said, "Don't be such a damn fool. I'll get back all right. I'm quite sure I can get back." It didn't worry me. It seemed, of course, I was abnormal at the time. I didn't feel that there was any danger at all at that moment. I got back to my platoon. I went across to them and said, you all got a bomb. We always take two bombs with us. And I said, "Well, get one in your hand, pull out the pin. Now hold it tight. And as soon as I yell charge, stand up and run 2 or 3 yards, throw your bomb, and I think we'll get into that trench. There's practically no wire in front of it." Now, I would notice the word "practically" here, speaking as Peter Hart and not as Adlam. I would also notice, if you tripped and fell with this grenade.
Yeah. Now, his men, they could easily have taken a really jaundiced view.
By jaundiced, you mean disaffected?
Disaffected, because, you know, Adlam's zeal and determination to get forward at all costs means that their lives are at stake. But they knew that they had no real say in the matter. So, you know, Adlam's powers of leadership and his blowtorch style of courage seem to have inspired them forward.
Because they do go with him. So I'm going to be Adlam again. They went like a bomb. They really did. I think that's wonderfully. They all up and ran and we got into our little bit of trench. There was no trench to the right of us. That's the German trench. They'd all been blown away. We were in this narrow bit of trench. And by this time, we had no bombs. Fantastic. He didn't say that. I said that. Sorry. There were bags of German bombs like condensed milk cans on top of a stick. On them were written 5 sec. Ooh, I wonder if sex is German for seconds. You had to unscrew the bottom and a little toggle ran out. You pulled that and you threw it. I'd noticed that the Germans were throwing them at us. Seen them coming over, wobbling as they did, pitching a bit short of me, luckily. I could count up to nearly 3 before the bang came. I experimented on one. I pulled the string and took a chance, counted 1, 2, 3. My servant beside me was looking over the trench and he said, "Bloody good shot, sir. Hit him on the chest. Hit the bugger." The Germans found their own bombs coming back at them. I think it rather put the wind up them. There were bags of them in the trench. With my few men behind me, I got them all to pick up bombs. I dumped all my equipment, and I love this touch, the next bit, except my prismatic compass. I thought, I bought that myself and I don't want to lose it. So the government can buy you stuff, get rid of it. Prismatic, I bought that, I'm keeping that. Anyway, I kept that over my shoulder. The men brought these armfuls of bombs along, and I just went gaily along, throwing bombs. I counted every time I threw, 1, 2, 3, and the bomb went. It was most effective. Then we got close to where the machine gun was, and it was zipping. I don't think we've had this mentioned before, but that's the nature of oral history. And it was zipping about. We didn't look up above. I got a whole lot of bombs ready, and I started throwing them as fast as I could. My servant, who was popping up every now and again, said, "They're going, sir, they're going." I yelled, "Run in, chaps, come on." We just charged up the trench like a load of mad things. Luckily, they were running. We never caught them, but we drove them out. Then we came to another machine gun post. They were keeping down the other people who had the longer journey to go over. He's moving towards the people that hadn't got any further so far. in the end, with these few men I had, we got right to our objective that the battalion was down to do. So he got the whole lot, the whole battalion objective. It's amazing. He carries on. They came up and cleared up. They took nearly 100 prisoners out of the dugouts. It was lucky they didn't come up behind us. But they were more frightened than we were. I was frightened, I don't mind telling you. Then the CO, commanding officer, saw two trenches leading up towards Schwaben Redoubt. And he said, it would be a good idea to get an advance post up there. They started off and a man got killed straight away. I said, oh, damn it, let me go. I can do it. I've done the rest of it. I can do this bit. So I went on. I bombed up the trench, put some men to look after that, bombed along this one there. It wasn't much of a trench at all, nearly blown to pieces. That was an easy job. Then I got to the other corner, bombed them out of there, bombed back down the way. We took more prisoners down there in dugouts. So we had our two advanced posts out towards the enemy. And this must be why so many VCs get killed. They do one amazing thing and then they're almost overconfident. And he just takes on another job that could have got him killed. But he was incredibly lucky. Would you not say he was as brave as he was? He was as lucky as anything.
Yeah, yeah. And even long after the event, you know, his words are conjuring up some idea of the desperate, mad excitement of the trench fight.
Exhilaration.
Yeah, it overcomes any idea of self-preservation or basic common sense. Yeah. So as to what was and was not possible, so it didn't dawn on him that anything was not possible. And although he probably barely noticed it at the time in his frenzied, should we call it a berserker attack? Adlam receives a wound in the leg.
It's only a minor one, but it's still a wound, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not that serious.
But so what would keep him going?
Well, sheer pumping adrenaline. Now, as you mentioned, he would be awarded a VC for his desperate courage that morning. And you're going to be once more, and I like the fact you're doing all the work, Lieutenant Tom Adlam.
Well, this is him thinking about what he'd done. He says this: you did a job out there and I never realised that there was anything unusual about it. There was a job to be done and you just got on and did it. I was more frightened going up to the trenches, sitting, waiting to start. I was very frightened then. Very frightened indeed. But when we got going, you've got a group of men with you. You're in charge of them. We were taught we had to be an example to our men and that if we went forward, they'd go with you, you see. And you sort of lose your sense of fear thinking about other people. Wow. Wow. Wow.
Now, it's only another couple of days later. He's in the thick of the action again.
I know what he feels like in a sense because I'm now feeling, does that mean I've got a load more quotes to read?
Yes.
Well, if I'm objected to reading a load more quotes, what must it have been like for him after this to now have to risk his life again? So what's happening this time?
Well, he's in the thick of the action again when the 18th Division is ordered to take the Schwaben Redoubt itself. So the 53rd and 54th Brigades are once more earmarked for the assault, supported by the reserve battalions of the 55th Brigade. Now, amongst the troops lined up for the attack was Lieutenant Tom Adlam again of the 7th Bedford.
Hang on, I'm wounded.
Oh, and he'd suffered very little reaction to his slight leg
wound. So this is more a nick than anything. I can say it would probably put you or me.
Yeah, but
you wouldn't have complained. But
he's able to stay with his unit. So once more, he's suffering the tension of waiting to go into the attack. And perhaps,
you know, I'm wondering, what do you think he's thinking? What would you think?
Well, even he was aware that he'd used a fair amount of normal reserves of luck and a couple of days before at Thiep Val. So as 0 hour was set for 1300, that's 1 o'clock, Pete.
Thanks.
He and his men had plenty of time for waiting around and thinking about it. And once more, you are going to be, and I love this, Lieutenant Tom Adlam, for several more quotes.
Now, I'd like people to, before I go on, while I remember, this is available on the War Museum. You can hear the whole interview on the War Museum webpage. I can't remember. If you type in Tom Adlam, A-D-L-A-M, and IWM, you should get to it. You can listen to the whole thing in his voice. It's an important resource. The War Museum's an amazing institution. I can't remember who did the interview. It wasn't me. It was done in the 70s. Anyway, this is what Tom has to say. Imagine he's ready to go over the top. We know he'll be nervous. He said this. They put us in the last line of attack and the other people in front, three companies. We sat waiting until 1 o'clock, but we got into position at 12. We sat down waiting. We sort of chattered away to keep our spirits up. Waiting for an hour for an attack is not a very pleasant thing. There was a nasty smell about there, and of course we all suggested somebody had had an accident. What does he mean, Gary?
We know what he means.
But it wasn't. It was a dead body, I think. We joked in that way, in a very crude manner, just to keep them alive and going. Now, this is we've written a book about this sort of thing, haven't we? It's a book that tries to be respectful, but looks at what it's like for men in action. And how did we sum it up? What's the title of the book?
Well, the title of the book is rather apt because it's called Laugh or Cry, because sometimes you would just have to choose one or the other.
Yeah, I'd have gone for crying, but these men have got a bit more about them, haven't they? They crack a joke. Who's farted? You can just imagine the lads, can't you? Anything to keep their minds off it. Anyway, who's next?
Well, when the artillery barrage opens up, it certainly seems to have done them justice. And the blasted earth of Schwaben Redoubt was once more thoroughly rearranged. And Tom Adlin comments about this.
Then when the shells started, they put everything in. You'd never think anything could have lived at all in the Schwaben Redoubt. And the old earth piled up. We went forward and you'd see one lot going to trench and another line going into a trench. Three lines had all met up and mingled together. Some of them were killed, so they weren't as strong as when they went in. We caught up with them, our last lot. By this time, we got this close to the Schwaben Redoubt. There was a huge shell crater, a mine crater, I think, because it was about 50 feet across. It was all lined with Germans popping away at us. So I got hold of the old bombs again and started trying to bomb them out. After a bit, we got them out of there and started charging up the trench, all my men coming on behind me very gallantly. We got right to within striking distance of the Schwaben Redoubt itself. Just at that moment, I got a bang in the arm and found I was bleeding. So being a bombing officer who could flow with both arms, I used my left arm for a while and I found I could bomb perfectly well with it as I could with my right. We went on for some time, holding on to this position and working our way up the trenches as far as we could. The men sort of lose all control. There was a German soldier. He'd been wounded. He was in a bad way. He was just moaning. Mercy, kamerad, mercy, kamerad. And this fellow in front of me, one of the nicest men I had in my platoon, he said, mercy, you bloody German, take that. He pointed his rifle point blank at him, just in front of me. But he jerked up and missed him. I gave him a shove from behind and said, go on, he won't do any harm. Let's go and get a good one. And it was so funny. The fellow said to me afterwards, sir, I'm glad I missed him. It was just the heat of the moment, you see. Then my CO came up and said, you're hurt, Tom. I said, only a snick in the arm. He said, let's have a look at it. And he put a field dressing on it. He said, you go on back. You've done enough. So I sat down for a while. The fight went on. But what happened afterwards, whether they actually took the Schwaben Redoubt, I don't know. I waited for some time and the CO said, well, you've got to go back. Take this batch of prisoners. I took about a dozen prisoners with me. They filed in front of me. I just my old gun and I walked back. And that was the war over for a bit for him. I don't know what happened to him now. I must look and listen to it again and find out. So what's happening behind him? He doesn't know what happened. What happened?
Well, behind him, the men of the 18th Division, they do sweep over the great German fortress. The Schwaben Redoubt, yes. Schwaben Redoubt.
Schwerpunkt.
Now, this is truly a ding-dong battle conducted in tight trenches. Battles raged over saps, corners, dugout entrances. But finally, as the 55th Brigade came up to throw themselves into the fray, the German garrison begins to give way.
But what, you mean this? The resistance starts to fray away?
Yeah, but the constant counterattacks meant that only on the 5th of October was the whole of the Schwaben Redoubt finally within the British
grip. Well,
that's
days later, days of this fighting.
Yeah, now the fighting, you know, it had a grim complexion of a true soldier's battle, because the two sides, they're fighting tooth and claw for every single inch of the ground on Thiepval Ridge. The story doesn't ever seem to change. The place names change by hour, but the essential plot remains the same. Another German redoubt has fallen. Another step to the British domination of Pozieres Ridge and Thiepval Spur.
So what you're saying is that there's a clear pattern to the fighting at this stage.
Yeah, it's fundamentally a battle of the artillery.
Well, I think it is on the Western Front generally. It's the dominant force, and this is why the British in the end do well in the Great War at the end of the war, because the British artillery becomes gains dominance.
The British can't advance without it, and the Germans, they can't defend without it. So the roar of the guns...
Unceasing, Gary.
It's going to grind away and erode the courage of all but the very bravest.
There's something else about the Somme. This phase in particular of the Somme, we've looked at what a tragedy it is for the British Army at times. It is a terrible tragedy. And no one is gainsaying that. It's awful for the British Army. We've talked about the losses on the 1st of July. We've talked about the summer madness. You know, some of the attacks in July and August are just stupid. We've talked about the terrible fighting that the Reserve Army's had. And before then, the Australians on this ridge. But the Somme's doing something else. What else is it doing?
There are more than one party on the Somme. So it's becoming a mincing machine for the German army as well. Fresh divisions are being sent into action, and then the British artillery are simply chewing them up over a period of days and spit them out at the end of it as mere shadows.
So this is like almost like the it's a bit like the German plan for Verdun, the alleged German plan for Verdun. It's a mincing machine that just brings in German divisions and spits them out, you're saying? Wow. Let's look at it. We've got one German quote. We should have had more. I've been lazy about putting a German quote in, but let's look at Herbert Sulzberg. He's Sergeant Herbert Sulzberg of the 63rd, that's Frankfurt, Field Artillery Regiment. Now, he'd spent some time in St. Quentin while en route to leave in Brussels. So in a way, he's a bit of a side, but he just happens to see what's happening of the German army going in and coming out of the line of the Somme. And this next quote that you're going to read, Gary, gives us an idea of how the German army's being chewed up.
In the 2 hours we had to wait there, a very large number of troops, some in column of route, moved through the town, coming from the Battle of the Somme, on their way to rest stations. They were ragged and filthy, with blunted nerves and indifferent expressions, while other troops, all fresh, clean, and without a notion of what it was like, were pushing the other way towards the Somme to be sent straight into action.
So they're pushing, you can see that, all fresh and going to action, 2 or 3 days in the line, and they're unceasing roar of British artillery, the stresses of combat, the attacks, the counterattacks. It just chews people up. So it's two sides. This is a battle of attrition. It's a terrible battle. And it's said that the German army leave their best men, their best NCOs, some of their best officers in the ground on the Somme. Does that mean it's all worthwhile? I don't know. I've never been able to decide. What I do know is the Somme is a terrible battle for both sides, and it does erode the German army. Now, what's happening? Well, just what do you think of, What is this? Are we in the battle?
Well, this
now?
Is the decisive moment, isn't it? The Germans are certainly staggering under the weight of the British attacks, and the wearing out battle reached its peak. But there is a question. The question is, would the Germans crack?
Now, that's what we have to address over the next few episodes. Will they crack? Can they keep on sending reserves? Remember, they're fighting at Verdun. That's not going away. In fact, the French are beginning to counterattack properly at Verdun. The whole battle is boiling up. The Germans are fighting two of these battles. The French are also attacking on the Somme. They're building up their attacks. In a future episode, we'll be looking at the French on the Somme with David O'Mara. This is all boiling up to a crescendo. And the question is, does the war finish in 1916? Will the Germans crack? Is it the Great War 1914-16?
Well, I don't know, Peter. We're going to have to wait and see.
Now, one other point we want to make is something about we've done this. This episode has been about a lot of personal experience. Why do we think that's important? Why do we want them less of you and me?
Well, the primary reason is you and me weren't there. So this is about what the lads' fault there and then. We you've raised it earlier. We had a quote the other week where somebody looked and saw some tanks. I think it was the Flares episode, and described thousands of tanks coming towards them. Now, clearly, there were not thousands of tanks, but that was his perspective, and he was there.
So the beauty of all a personal experience accounts, because it's not all oral history, it's personal experience, diaries, letters, all sorts of things, is that they're not always accurate, but they do give us a sense of what it was like. And I think the quotes today have given us a very real feeling. It's not all about RIP and feeling sad and having almost a fake sort of sadness about the whole thing. What this is about is learning what it was like, appreciating what these men suffered and why they suffered and how they suffered and what was going on, and trying to gain an understanding of what was going on rather than just feeling sad about it. That's what I feel.
Well, yeah, I would add to that, but it's also having an appreciation of where they believed they were having success and where they believed they were making a difference. Because, you know, very often we look at the Great War and particularly the Somme in a particular way. But there was success, and individuals on the ground were making the difference. Tom Adlam made a difference.
Frank Maxwell made a difference at Trones Wood and probably at Teapfel as well. So it's a big picture, isn't it? And it's too complicated. It's too complicated for us at times. It has to be said. In fact, it's much too complicated for us.
Curly Whirly's too complicated for us. That's why we've stopped eating them.
Well, I fancy a Curly Whirly now. I wish you hadn't mentioned that.
Let's go and get a Curly Whirly. Cheers, Pete.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?